citizen who is the guardian of America, armed and free.
Welcome to America, Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom. Colonel Oliver North is a man who truly needs no introduction. He's done a lot for his country, both on the air and, of course, in the service of his country in the Marine Corps. Colonel North, you're cleared and hot, as they say.
Hey, Charles, it's great to be with you and all your great friends all over America, buddy.
Thank you ever so much for your service to this country and also for your rather courageous actions in covering the recent war in Iraq. I found it rather interesting to note that the New York Times has put out a specific edict that says that in combat areas, its reporters will not be armed against a threat. Does that make sense to you?
Well, they've also put out an edict somewhere that says that they're not going to say anything good about American troops either. I mean, they've got a guy up there who describes American soldiers as, quote, uneducated people who couldn't get a job anywhere else. And that's why they're in the military. Totally wrong, but that's kind of typical of the New York Times. Set an agenda, and they mean to carry it out.
What is the profile of the American soldier today, Colonel North?
Average age, 19 and a half. He is a high school graduate. All of them are. Once he got in the military, he's been trained in chemistry and physics, biology, avionics, ballistics. It's the best educated military that any country has ever had in the entire history of the planet Earth. They're bigger. They're tougher. They're better led, better equipped than any military ever before. No other military has ever gone so far, so fast, with so few casualties. On average, they are 9 points ahead of the average in IQ in America. Many of them already have post-high school education, and in fact, a far greater number than ever before as enlisted soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines have college degrees. And they are what I describe as the warriors of 9-1-1. They came into the military because of 9-1-1. They aim to see this battle through to the end of it. They grasp what's going on far more than apparently most of the people in the New York Times and many people in America.
Before I ask you about your new book, War Stories, which is excellent, what can my audience do to support our troops?
One of the things we need to do is pray for them. I deeply believe in the power of prayer. I've seen the evidence of that out there with these guys. They need to be able to send them things like care packages. And if they're going to do that, let me recommend some things that they include. Mm-hmm. Baby wipes, because you can use a baby wipe to clean your body, clean your weapon, and do all manner of things that baby wipes were originally intended for, plus a whole lot more. Put some beef jerky in there, M&Ms, because they melt in your mouth, not in your pocket.
Or in your baby wipes.
Exactly. And that's the kind of stuff that, if you send that out there to them, the youngster who gets it will be a hero for a day. And people say, well, I don't know the name or an address. You go down to any recruiting station. And don't wrap the box up yet, because they're going to want to make sure that there's nothing in there that's wrong, because unfortunately we have people in this country that would do crazy things. You can't send aerosol cans of shaving cream, but you can put disposable razors. You can put in tubes of toothpaste and tubes of shaving cream. Those kinds of things mean a lot to those guys up there, because there are no PXs up at Tikrit and Beji and places like that that I've been with them.
Yeah, Saddam didn't look too good when they pulled him out of the hole. He wasn't near a PX.
What a coward.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, that picture, by the way, and you think about what that picture means, Charles, it means not only were these guys very good at what they did, the self-discipline of that young United States Army sergeant, not to just drop a grenade in that hole, not to fire his automatic weapon down there, but to put himself at risk with his night vision goggles on, his adrenaline racing, to look down in that hole and find this bloody despot and haul him out and let the world see what a coward he was. That picture of that really, I mean, serious terror is going to change the world.
How hard must it have been to not put the selector on full and hold it down for 30
exactly
rounds?
Exactly right. But that's the kind of self-discipline that these guys have. It's remarkable. I'm blessed to have the job that I've got, Charles. All I do is Thank God. I don't have to run around after Michael Jackson or Kobe Bryant or any or politicians waiting for him to say something memorable. My beat for Fox News is soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines. All I do is hang around with heroes.
Hey, you left out the Coast Guard.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm about to do. We're starting next week on a special about the Coast Guard.
Hmm.
And so it's vastly underrated as a service of our armed forces, and yet they are. In fact, were it not for Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, which I covered for Fox back in 2001, if it weren't for those two military operations, it would be more dangerous and life-threatening to be in the Coast Guard than it would be to be in the U.S. Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. We just did the last hour on a book from Homer Hickam, which largely involved Coast Guard operations in World War II off the Hatteras. Yes, it is. Is it the oldest continuous service?
It is. The Marine Corps brags about it because we were started on November
10th, 1775. Right.
But in fact, the Revenue Cutter Service, which is the predecessor to the Coast Guard, precedes any of the armed forces of the United States.
Well, I bet not too many people say this to you, Colonel. Semper Paratus.
Always ready. Mm-hmm. See? The guys who know Semper Fidelis also know Semper Paratus.
Yeah, I bet so. One of the reasons, in my opinion, this is my opinion for your success, is the level of trust you engender from the greenest PFC to the actual commander-in-chief and getting them to confide in you. How do you do that?
Part of it is, again, I've got advantages that a lot of my colleagues don't have. I don't have to consult a reference guy to know the cyclic rate of fire for a 240 Golf machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
I know the difference between an F-15 and an F-14. And I can speak their lingo because I did it for a quarter of a century. And interestingly enough, most of these youngsters, I'm talking about that average soldier, sailor, airman, marine, or guardsman out there, 19 and a half years of age, has no idea about Ollie North except that he's got a television show on Fox that lets them tell their own stories, war stories on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern, and I've been there with them. And that gives them, I think, a certain confidence that I'm not going to betray them. I don't pretend, Charles, to be a, quote, unbiased correspondent. I didn't learn journalism at U.S. Naval Academy. I learned to file an honest report. And so what I do is I let these guys tell their stories, and quite frankly, they do a far better job at it than any of the talking heads. I mean, we can all stand there with a microphone in our hands talking about the flaming wreckage behind us or whatever, but when you put these guys on and let them tell their stories and document it for the world, they come across as just as great as they really are. And quite honestly, if somebody told me as a battalion commander, North, we're going to let some guy wander around your battalion with a live satellite camera and broadcast to the world exactly what he's seen. No escorts, no public affairs officer. This is before we were all embedded. I'd have said, you guys are nuts. Because my recollection and my sentiment toward the media, my colleagues, is very much based on Vietnam. And these guys would come out for a couple of hours and sometimes even a few days and then go back and file their stories over the bar after they'd all colluded on how bad they wanted to make Americans look, Americans in combat. That's the way it was done in Vietnam. Well, it was a brilliant idea to go back to the World War II methodology.
The Ernie Pyle model.
Exactly. Ernie Pyle, who covered the war from North Africa all the way through the Italian campaign, through Normandy and France, and tragically is killed on Iwo Jima in the last battle of the Pacific War just before VJ Day.
By a sniper.
Yep. But see, Ernie Pyle was embedded, just like we were out there. And what Rumsfeld did, it was really his idea, was to have these guys, if you're going to cover the war, you're going to have to go out there and live with them. You're not just going to go file a story back in the bar.
Or show up after the battle.
Or exactly. You're going to be there, and you're going to let these guys be seen for as good as they really are. It was a wonderful testament to the faith that Rumsfeld and the Joint Chiefs of Staff had in these young troopers, because there were no escorts. There were no officers running around censoring what we did. And for the most part, nearly all of the correspondents out there filed stories that didn't prognosticate on what we were going to be doing tomorrow. That was forbidden. They didn't show the faces of American dead, although we were allowed to photograph everything. But you didn't show prisoners of war faces, which is forbidden by the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, most of the camera angles are for the back or side.
Exactly. And it worked. And I think the American people would agree that they got a better balanced picture of what was going on those embedded correspondents than they were getting from the New York Times or the Washington Compost or any of these other newspapers. Or, quite frankly, the Jane Fonda Network, which chose to give us, instead of the perspective of the American fighting man, what they gave us was what Atlanta wanted us to hear, and that was Baghdad Bob.
Mm-hmm. You'd have gotten a real kick out of, they used to insist that I play CNN News at the bottom of the hour.
Oh, dear.
I had a kind of a, in fact, I was kind of dreading having you on hold and having you hear that, but I told them that I would play it on one condition, and that condition was I would do a disclaimer on the news, and they said, fine, we don't care, do anything you want. So I'll tell you the disclaimer. We invite you to stay tuned for CNN News at the bottom of the hour, which we can neither verify nor endorse. Any opinions therein are strictly those of the network and not those of Liberty Watch or America Armed and Free.
God love you.
America Armed and Free is a program based in objective reality and biased towards individual freedom. Here to provide counterbalance to those is CNN. I did that for about 3 weeks, and they said, okay, you don't have to play CNN anymore. So,
well, you know, by the way, I mean, you talk about America's liberties, and that's, of course, what the name of your network here is.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, CNN went out of its way, I remember this vividly, to find a sheriff who was anti-gun. Now, full disclaimer here, you know, I think all of our listeners need to know, I happen to be a member of the board of directors of the National
Rifle Association. Right, yeah.
I'm proud to be so. Charlton Heston asked me to become one, and I campaigned for it and ran for it, and proud to be reelected every time I've run. But I can remember vividly CNN going out of its way to find a Florida sheriff who was anti-gun and put on a real assault weapon and described that as the kind of assault weapon that was going to be banned, but Chris already banned. AK-47s are already banned. You can't buy an AK-47 anywhere that fires in full automatic.
Well, respectfully, Colonel, there in Arizona you can, and it's legal. And in 36 states, it's regulated heavily by the 1934 NFA.
I should have been...
Yeah, you can buy one. You can't buy one at a storefront gun shop. You can buy one if it's specially registered and you pay the tax with ATF.
Exactly. But it is carefully regulated.
And it's not a common item.
Criminals don't get their hands on it.
Right.
And yet, the sheriff in that CNN special, which they ran several times, flat out lied, and everybody at CNN knew it was a lie, but they kept running it. It was only after the NRA and a number of other groups went after him that they finally did a very brief 20-second disclaimer on it, said, well, basically there's other alternative perspectives on this thing. I mean, the fact is, the Second Amendment is anathema to most of the people in Atlanta running that network.
Mm-hmm. It's not about hunting. If it, God forbid, is a last resort, if it becomes necessary, when the agents of the government are sent to take away your freedom, the only thing left to do is to deal with them that way.
Charles, I go to work every day when I'm not over in Afghanistan or Somalia or Djibouti or Iraq covering American military. If I'm going to work for Fox in Washington, I have to drive into the District of Columbia, which happens to be the most gun-controlled city in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it has the second highest murder rate in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And my producer isn't allowed to have a shotgun in his house. You think about what that means in terms of home defense and everything else. My son, who lives in Richmond, had his home broken into last week and is convinced, as I am, that if he hadn't had several firearms available, he and his wife and two little babies might well be dead at this minute.
Yep, I understand completely. As a firearms instructor myself, certified by the state of Arizona, I teach that it's essential to have multiple modes of defense, more than one weapon system, and to have a layered defense. For instance, dogs outside, bars on the window, alarm system, and a firearm as a last resort. And also to have intermediate modalities like OC spray and a pistol. I noticed in the video that went along with your book, War Stories, that the DVD disc that was in there, that most of the men in Iraq were carrying sidearms as well as rifles.
Oh, absolutely.
How critical is that philosophy to recent combat in Iraq?
Well, in fact, it reflects a dramatic change in the way people think about warfare. I mean, much of current combat, of course, is at very long range. I mean, you've got guided mm-hmm. munitions, but mm-hmm. then when you get right down to, in fact, one of the generals that I quote in the book, and I interviewed very few generals out there.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Came to me and said, how come you don't put me on here? I said, because, General, nobody cares what you had for breakfast today. You know, I was an officer. Officers are always so worried about saying the wrong thing, they don't say anything. I'd much rather put a Lance Corporal on, and there's a lot more Lance Corporals than there are generals out here.
How'd the general react?
He'd been one of my lieutenants years ago, because he kind of chuckled about it. But he made the observation in that very brief interview that I did do with him. General Conway, who commanded all the Marines out there, 66,000 of them, said, on the day the war started, the 20th of March, we knew where every single Iraqi tank was. What we didn't know was that 5,000 to 6,000 Fedayeen had come into the country from Saudi Arabia, through Kuwait, through Jordan, through Syria, from Egypt, Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and that they'd flooded into the country. And these people weren't simply willing to die for their cause. They wanted to die.
Yeah, they wanted to die.
And there's a big difference. And so what they ended up doing, even before the war started, because they were anticipating this, is, and you can see this in the video, and you can see it in the pictures, guys are carrying a saw and a 9mm.
Mm-hmm.
He's carrying a
saw stands for squad automatic weapon. Go ahead,
right.
Colonel North.
Or he's carrying a 240 Golf machine gun, and he's got a G4 slung over his shoulder. I mean, he's or an MP4 or whatever. I mean, he's got additional firepower. The regimental commander had with him his 9mm. He had the new Benelli automatic shotgun, which is mm-hmm. just magnificent.
It's the M90?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just an absolutely beautiful shotgun. 7 rounds, alternating double-aught buck and slug. And on top of his Humvee, he's got a 50 caliber. And on the other two Humvees that accompanied him, he had an automatic 40mm grenade launcher and one of the new AT-4 launchers.
I'd say it was good for a Saturday night in D.C.
It would almost protect you in Washington.
Almost.
Almost.
If you had some armor to go along with it.
I'm not trying to take anything from cops. I love cops. The problem is, as my son found out, you call the cops, you dial 911, and the cop arrives to record the history of the crime that was committed.
Mm-hmm.
He's not there to prevent the crime. He can't. Mm-hmm. They can't possibly put enough cops out there until these judges start locking up the criminals. He can't possibly put enough cops on the street in order to protect people from the crime that's about to be committed. You can only record the history of the one that was committed.
And you don't want to live in a society where there are enough cops to protect you, because that's then called a police state. Bear with us for just a minute, if you would, Colonel North, because we're going to take a brief break. One of the things we're going to do, though, this hour is, my sponsors have agreed, I'm going to briefly mention each and every one of them and tell you where to get them, and then we're not going to take any time away from Colonel North. So if you want to dial in, now's the time. This is a golden opportunity to talk directly to Colonel Oliver North himself. I want to thank very much Diamondback Police Supply. They have some of the world's best flashlights for sale. Their number is 886-8338, 886-8338. Also to Perfection Auto Works. They do a phenomenal job of servicing both foreign and domestic cars. Their number is 323-8650. And to Packham Firearms and Mercantile, if you are a cowboy shooter, you absolutely need to be in their store. And their number is 888-1600, 888-1600. And back to Colonel Oliver North, who has graciously granted us an hour of his Sunday. And Colonel North, much is made in the media about whether or not Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. You've interviewed Qadir Hamza, known as Saddam's bomb maker. What did we know that Iraq had? I'm not talking about what did we guess, what did we think, but what did we know Iraq had, and what American officials have confirmed it?
We know for a fact that Saddam Hussein had chemical and biological weapons and had a nuclear weapons program. I mean, the nuclear weapons program dated back to 1979, started with the help of the French. The Israelis bombed that reactor in 1981.
Can I interrupt your answer for just a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know who got you know who scored the biggest hit on that raid?
Oh yeah, the guy was just killed in the shuttle.
That's right, Ramon, Ilan Ramon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Continue, please.
And then they went about rebuilding that again with the assistance of the French, and the French knew well what they were trying to do, and that was to enrich uranium to use for weapons grade uranium, trying to build a uranium bomb. They also made efforts, notwithstanding all this business about Niger and whether it was yellow cake uranium and what it was going to be used for. They made efforts all over the world to get that kind of technology. We also know for a fact, and this has just come out, Hamza said when he was working on the bomb inside Iraq for Saddam Hussein, he knew that they were acquiring technology from Korea. What he didn't know, of course, then, and we now know, is that the Koreans got that from the Pakistanis. And, of course, that's all come out in recent weeks. We know also that he had a chemical weapons program, that he used those weapons against the Iranians, against the Kurds, and against the Shia during the 1980s, and again in 1991. We also know that he had stores of weapons that were destroyed by the UN inspectors starting in 1992. And through 1996, those weapons stores routinely were being destroyed. The photographic evidence of that is there. What's unaccounted for is about 50,000 cubic yards, or cubic meters, if you will, of what they call dual-use chemical that can be combined with one another, the two chemicals, which would basically, in a compressed liquid form, fill two tank trucks about the size you see hauling milk up and down any highway in America. Where those two tank trucks went, we don't know. And quite frankly, when all of these different reports come out, they're going to have to acknowledge they still don't know where this stuff disappeared to. Dr. David Kaye acknowledged that in his comments to Congress. What he said in Congress was, I could find no sign that Saddam Hussein was actually making more of this. In other words, the weapons of mass destruction didn't exist according to what people extrapolate from his comment. What he then went on to say, and is very rarely reported by anybody, is, however, I know from when I was the chief UN weapons inspector that we couldn't account for these two, if you will, tank trucks loaded with this stuff. We still can't account for that. And at some point, I'm confident we will find out what happened to it. That part is never being reported nowadays. So what we actually know is that two tank truck loads full of this stuff have disappeared.
What stuff?
These chemical agents that, when they're combined with one another, make a very lethal nerve toxin. We also know that every single Iraqi soldier, 485,000 of them, every one of them had gas masks, atropine injectors, which are used for nerve gas, and decontamination equipment. They had all of that stuff with them, basically from every country on the planet Earth, except the United States and Great Britain.
Based on your experience in the military, would you ever equip an army with that if there wasn't a possibility of that being used?
Never. And, of course, they know well that we don't have that stuff. We've not had it since the 1980s.
We're going to go to the phones and say we want to keep it to one question. Our board is full, and I expect it'll stay full throughout the hour of the interview. Please, one question, no speeches, and go for it. Chris, you're live on America Armed and Free with Colonel Oliver North.
I just wanted to say hello, Colonel. I've been following you since 1987, and thank you for your service to our country.
Well, thank you,
honor
Chris.
To talk to
I
you,
appreciate
sir.
That.
A question for him, Chris?
No question, just that comment.
Thank you for your comment, sir.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What went through your mind, Colonel North, when you heard that Abu Abbas had been captured?
Well, you know, this is a guy that 18 years ago we tried to catch. Abu Abbas is the guy who masterminded the hijacking of the cruise ship at Kielce Laurel.
He made everyone know the name Leon Klinghoffer.
Who was murdered. I mean, this shows you how brave these terrorists are. These three thugs aboard the ship, at the direction of Abu Abbas, find a Jewish passenger confined to a wheelchair. He can't even run and hide. He's on the 50th anniversary of he and his wife are celebrating their marriage. And they're on this cruise ship. They roll him down to the aisle in his wheelchair, shoot him in the face in front of his wife, and throw his body over the side of the rail into the Mediterranean. That's what these guys did. Cruise ship pulls into Alexandria Harbor. Mubarak allows them to escape, puts them on an Egyptian airliner, lies to Ronald Reagan in the process. We forced the airplane down in Sigonella, thanks to the U.S. Navy and the 6th Fleet, and then the U.S. Navy SEALs and the Delta Force. General Carl Steiner takes them into possession. The Italians demand that he be turned over to them because it's Italian territory. The Italians help Abu Abbas escape. They put him in Yugoslavia was a country at the time. They put him in Yugoslav airline uniform, fly him to Split, Yugoslavia on a Yugoslav airliner out of Leonardo da Vinci Airport. From there, he goes to Tunis, where at the time Yasser Arafat gave him a big hero's welcome. He then goes to Damascus, Syria, and finds his way to Baghdad, Iraq. And he's captured in Baghdad by the U.S. Marines and is at this point awaiting a military tribunal as a terrorist. Interestingly enough, he is the guy, as the head of the Palestine Liberation Front, who has been sending the $50,000 checks to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade for blowing themselves up and killing as many Jews as they can. The bomb jackets that we found at Salman Pak are exactly the same kind that are being used on buses in Tel Aviv and Haifa.
Explain bomb jackets.
Bomb jacket is, in most cases, a leather jacket, although some of them are cloth. I mean, I saw all kinds of them there.
You can have both explosives and a fashion statement?
Oh, yes. Some of them, by the way, purchased from the duty-free shop at Heathrow.
Well, you don't want to pay tax on your bomb jacket.
I guess. And they bring them down there, and they take the lining out. They line it with plastic explosive, a lot of it from Libya, some Semtech coming out of the Soviet Union or the Russians. Line it with strips of that, set detonator wires in between each one of them, wire it all together with a blasting cap and PETN, which is a det cord.
Det cord, right.
And hook it up to a detonator. Sew the batteries into the lining of the coat. So the only thing the guy has to do is touch the two contacts together, which they often do by running two wires down the sleeve of the jacket and hooking them up to two little pieces of aluminum foil. So all he has to do is touch his two fingers together, thumb and forefinger, or a forefinger and second finger, close them together, makes the contact, blows himself to pieces. The plastic explosive has on the outside of it nails, nuts and bolts, ball bearings, anything that will throw fragments all over the place. And, of course, when you're carrying 10 pounds of explosive wrapped around your body, it's devastating inside a bus. Of course, we've seen the evidence of that.
Yeah.
This is the guy who was organizing that for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, which are often characterized as a jihadist unit. And they are. It's a jihadist terrorism organization. The Hamas, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Islamic Brotherhood, Hezbollah, all of these organizations and offices at Salman Pak, and this is the guy that was the finance minister for all of this stuff.
And why has George Bush not declared the war on terrorism to include Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade? It kind of sounds like a law firm, doesn't it? Jihad, Al-Aqsa, and and Hamas Corporation. Why has he not declared that part of the
Hezbollah,
war on terror?
Hezbollah is on the list. And Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade is on the list. Islamic Jihad Organization has been on the list and is now off the list. It'll be back on. I think as people wake up to the fact that, if you will, terror you, the place where you send your young terrorist recruit out of a madrasa. He's been trained since he was 5 or 6 years old in hatred. He's learned to hate, to kill himself, and to kill others, as many as possible in the process. In other words, he's been taught how to die. And they go from that little madrasa to terror you. It used to be at Tora Bora. For a while it was at Salman Pak. Now it's in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. Well, you say the Lebanese. Well, the Lebanon is basically...
Creature of Syria.
It's the 17th province of Syria.
Right.
Let's not kid ourselves. Nothing happens in the Bekaa Valley except that what the government in Damascus wants to happen. And so when we look at Assad's son, people say, well, he's more moderate than his dad. This is a patrimonial dictatorship in which Assad is using those organizations to attack Israel and, by extension, to kill Americans. We keep forgetting. Americans are dying routinely in Israel because they happen to be on a bus, they're a college student, they're a high school student,
mm-hmm.
the family's over there for one business or another in Israel, and Americans are dying regularly in Israel. That's something else that's not being reported very widely. In the attack just 2 weeks ago, there were two Americans on that bus.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I think this administration needs to do is face up to the fact that, in the words of a young sergeant, when I was at Beji, Iraq, just a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
a jihadist terrorist in a pickup truck full of explosives races up to the barrier, realizes he's not going to get through it, and so at about 75 yards away, detonates himself and the pickup truck with about 700 pounds of explosives in the back of it. Doesn't kill any Americans. In fact, doesn't even wound any. What he does do is kill 10 Iraqis who just happen to be walking down the street. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And what the young sergeant, United States Army, 4th Infantry Division, turns to me and says, he says, you know, I keep hearing from Washington that this is not a religious war. But let me tell you, for that guy who just blew himself to pieces, it's very much a religious war.
Oh, boy, it sure is. You just spoke about Beji, and in Beji, you inspected an ammo dump with millions of rounds of ammunition, rocket-propelled grenades, and the most threatening of all, the SA-7. I believe that's called the Grail.
And SA-14s, which is the improved version.
Yeah, and the SA-9s as well. Yep. All of them Soviet designs, if not Russian manufactured. Many of the boxes were open and the weapons were missing from them.
You got it.
What happened to those weapons, and what's the chance, in your opinion, as an analyst and an insider of intelligence information, is the possibility of those weapons appearing, migrating to U.S. soil?
300 million tons of ordnance in that ammunition supply point, that ASP,
mm-hmm.
and it's one of about 100 inside Iraq. It's the most militarized country on the planet Earth. That's now been, of course, secure. It, of course, for months, it was very difficult to secure all these sites. There wasn't enough chain link fence, because the first thing the Iraqi people did when Saddam started to go down, starting on the 9th of April, was to go up and rip up every government facility they could find. In fact, the battalion commander up there did something very smart. He said, look, there was chain link fence around this place. We've got it in aerial photographs. I wonder where it went. So he sends his scout reconnaissance platoon out. And he says, find the guy who's got this stuff, because somebody's got it. They find a warehouse full of rolled up chain link fence that's clearly been out in the weather. And they say, okay, bring the guy in. So they bring him in. And he sweats him a little bit. And he realizes this is the guy who's an entrepreneur. He's gone into the chain link fence business. He says, I'll tell you what, I'm going to pay you from impounded funds, in other words, money that they collected up from Saddam and that they found in all these Republican Guard sites. By the way, brand new American $50 and $100 bills.
Minted
in Iraq? Still in their treasury wrappers.
Minted in Iraq or U.S.?
No, this is real stuff. This is the real U.S. American dollar bills, which he was getting from the Oil for Food program. And he says, I'll pay you to put it up. How much do you want? He says, I want $4 a foot. He says, baloney, $1 a foot, that's all you're going to get. Put it back up. And for $1 a foot, he he put the fence back up from the guy who had the fence.
Is that a typical recon mission?
Well, no.
Scout me a fence.
But it shows how innovative these guys are, how smart these guys are. I'll tell you another one here in a minute. But what's happened is the hundreds of cases of surface-to-air missiles that were broken into, the best you can hope for, the very best you can hope for, is that most of the people using these things don't know how to use them, and second of all, that the batteries have not been properly charged, and therefore they're not going to be able to bring down an airplane. But we know that at least one has been hit. We believe that two other helicopters have been hit by these surface-to-air missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And if they've been exporting these things around the world, God help us.
Yeah, a C-130 got hit by one, I believe.
That's right. A C-130, the DHL aircraft got hit, and one helicopter that they're pretty sure was hit by. The helicopters have ALE and ALQ distractor systems aboard them, and if they're not working at 100%, there's a good likelihood that enough shrapnel from that 4 or 9 pound charge in the front of it can indeed bring those engines.
It can suck enough in the engine, or can ding up the tail rotor, and that'll do the same job.
You got it.
Bear with us for just a second, Colonel North, if you would. The sponsors have graciously agreed that we are going to abate the ad so that we have the full hour with Colonel North. But I want to acknowledge them briefly. Perfection Auto Works, where you can get any foreign and domestic car worked on, 323-8650. Hartman Glass, where you can get very, very artistic work done if you're doing a remodel job on your home or just a simple glass replacement, at 903-0766. Crescent Tobacco Shop, a newsstand located at 200 West Congress and also at Tanque Verde in Sabino Canyon, in business since 1908. And that'll do it for the sponsors for this hour. We're going to go back to the phones. And, Sheldon, you're live on the air with Colonel Oliver North.
Colonel North, you refer to the Geneva Accords. They prohibit the photos of POWs. And since there are so many unaccounted for U.S. military personnel from several wars, how would the Geneva Accords be amended so as to take out the unnecessary restriction of publicity or photos of POWs held in captivity or sequestered, whatever country they're in?
Well, Sheldon, I mean, first of all, the United States abides by that. And I don't know of many, if any, taken by U.S. cameramen during this war or any other war. What you find, however, is that nearly every other country, the Geneva Conventions are observed in their breach. And so, for example, let's take Vietnam, where we know that there's nearly 2,000 unaccounted for who were, in some cases, seen by others. I mean, there's photographic evidence somewhere in Hanoi of those people. Let me just give you my quick read on Hanoi. They know that at least 600 that I know of, because I documented this in 1993 in my book, One More Mission, when Clinton was pushing everybody for recognition of the...
Sir, no profanity on the air, please.
Sorry. Lost my head, Charles. So
former occupant of the White House.
Yeah, when this president's predecessor forced recognition, and I went to Hanoi, and I confronted him on this, and they said, no, there's no evidence whatsoever. Well, the fact is, the 600 that we know of that are missing, who were prisoners at one point in time, there's documentary evidence somewhere in Hanoi about that. And my belief is that once this generation of leadership, the people that were involved in the murder of those Americans who are prisoners of war, are gone, eventually that evidence will come clean. I mean, you can't hide a conspiracy for long. I mean, you may be able to hide it for 20 years or 50 years, but eventually it all comes out.
Yeah,
that's one of the things I've learned in documenting World War II. I mean, all this business about, for example, I'll give you one. In the aftermath of World War II, May of 1945, when the war ended in Europe, through June of the following year, over 1,000 American servicemen were killed by SS terrorists, who in some cases described themselves as the Wolverines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these guys murdered 1,000-plus Americans. You never hear that talked about.
No, you don't, because it would have been bad for morale.
Exactly. And so it was suppressed.
Furthermore, tens of thousands of people who were liberated from concentration camps were then murdered by some of their own countrymen when we returned them.
Exactly right. And I mean, the forced repatriation to Eastern Europe is unconscionable.
Absolutely.
At the time, Americans didn't want these, quote, undesirable DPs, as they were called, displaced persons, coming to America.
Mm-hmm. Which is a crime in and of itself.
Quite frankly, it is. Again, I mean, it's easy to point fingers back at Harry Truman today. It's a different world today than it was then. But I think people have come to a recognition that those people would have been far better off. They've been productive members of American society. It would not have been a terrible burden. And you're talking something in the neighborhood of 250,000 people to maybe a maximum of 1 million who would have been alive today had they been allowed to come to this country.
Certainly, but the issue there was not what they would do to the country. The issue was whether or not the politicians that would work against them would be elected. And unfortunately, it's how we governed then, and to a large extent, it still is how we govern today. Back to the phones, and Hill, you're live on America Armed and Free with Colonel Oliver North.
Yes, thank you. First, I want to thank you, Charles, and I want to thank you, Oliver, Colonel, for your service to our country. I'm a Vietnam veteran of 16-month service with the 101st Airborne.
Screaming Eagles.
16 months in Vietnam, and you kind of wonder how a guy got out after 4 months.
Correct.
Sorry, just let that slip.
If I may, that wasn't across the bow. That was amidships and in the bridge, Colonel. Okay, go ahead.
Colonel, what I've seen, especially in Vietnam, and now I see it now with the way the Democrats are trying to attack our president, which I think is doing the best job he can, is the politicization of what's going on. People don't remember what happened in 9/11. It's like what happened in World War II. You ask a kid today, they don't know anything. Vietnam War, they don't know anything. Korean War veterans got, pardon my French, crapped on, probably the worst of anybody.
Forgotten War is what they call it, Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know,
for good reason.
If we could keep the politicians out of it and let the military do what it was best designed to do, and I think President Bush 1 did what's correct, and I think President Bush 2 did what was correct. We don't have any of this politicization that's been going on.
Part of the problem, and I write about this in this book, and I've written about it in others, is that
Colonel, this book that you're referring to is War Stories, Operation Iraqi Freedom, available on all the major bookstores and on your website, too?
OliverNorth.com. They're all signed there. And that, by the way, that website, Charles, goes to support a scholarship fund for youngsters who have lost a parent serving in the line of duty in the armed forces.
I want to come back to that, but I don't
want
to take you off the
hill. One of the things that we as conservatives and people who believe in liberty need to understand, there's a strain in American politics today, and it goes back to the 60s primarily.
Correct, sir.
Of embarrassment about America. They're embarrassed that this country has been blessed with bounty beyond measure, with resources so vast we can barely quantify them all. They're embarrassed about the diversity of our population, the productivity of our people, the prosperity that we enjoy, and quite frankly, the generosity that we engage in. I mean, Americans per capita give away, this is before Uncle Sugar shows up and takes the rest of it in taxes. Americans give away more per capita than any other two countries on the planet Earth combined. You take any other country, UK, Canada, doesn't matter, Japan, we give away to charities, churches, synagogues, temples, charities, more money per person than any other country on the planet Earth. And then Uncle Sam comes and takes the other 39 or 40% of it.
Yes, sir.
What you've got in this country is an embarrassment about what we enjoy, as though somehow we're responsible for it. We didn't put this stuff here. We didn't give ourselves this population. They came as refugees from all over the planet, fleeing oppression, tyranny, economic opportunity that they didn't have in their home countries, and they became productive members of this culture and society. They brought Judeo-Christian values with them. Look at the firefight over the movie The Passion. And it's a repudiation of what made this country great. And so you see that in particular when it comes to fighting, particularly overseas. America has never, ever sent its sons and daughters and put them in harm's way to colonize anyone. We've never done anything for anybody that we've conquered except give them more than we possibly could have taken.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't fight this war for oil. We fought this war to give opportunity and the hope of freedom, like we enjoy, to a part of the world that's never had it.
That's true,
sir.
We've
never had it. And if you think about what started, and not to take undue credit for the Reagan administration that I served in.
But you had a piece of it, after all.
It began in 1983, the very first reversal of communism. Was on a little island called Grenada. If you look at the world in 1983, all over Latin America, there were dictatorships of the left and right.
True.
They're all gone except for one.
Mm-hmm.
And it then spread to Eastern Europe. And the wall came down. Ronald Reagan pointed at the wall and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. I was just in Berlin 2 weeks ago. And we're doing an episode of War Stories coming up in this new season about Berlin. And you know, the book that was written in 1994 when the final peace treaty, what they call the 2+4 treaty, was signed, ending World War II, because up until then it was a ceasefire. 1994, the final treaty, and a book was done by our State Department. That book, written in 1994, published by Madeleine Albright, the dancing diva of diplomacy, doesn't even have a picture, much less a caption, about Ronald Reagan standing there pointing to the wall and saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Well, that's why it all ended. And now the next part of the world where that should happen, where democracy should flourish, where free enterprise should allow people to prosper, where people have something to live for instead of something to die for, is the Middle East. And it's going to work in Baghdad. And when there's democracy in Baghdad, people in places like Riyadh and Amman and Cairo and Tehran are going to look at it and say, gosh, it's working there. Why doesn't it work here? Why don't we have liberty?
And you know where next after that? Cuba.
Try Africa. And try Cuba.
Cuba.
I keep hoping, but then you've got people in the government, to include some Republicans like Pat Roberts there in Kansas, who just blasted me. He's a Republican. Just blasted me for criticizing Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact is, it's a dictatorship. It's a communist dictatorship. Why do you ever see anybody get in a leaky raft and paddle from Key West to Havana?
Leaky raft? Heck, they had somebody convert a Buick.
That was great.
I thought there was, and there was another one with a pickup truck.
Yeah.
I thought it was just incredible.
Same family. Same family.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
They've taken their welding kit away from them.
Listen, I support their right to keep and bear welding kits. I'm going to change this just a little bit, Colonel North. A fellow by the name of Rick Cook said, quote, the key to understanding the American system is to imagine that you have the power to make nearly any law you want, but your worst enemy is going to be the one to enforce it. Would you trust President Hillary Clinton with the Patriot Act enforcement?
It's frightening. And by the way, that's why the sunset provisions of the Patriot Act are so important. I mean, just imagine having Janet Fireball Weno as your attorney general.
That was they were crazy. So isn't that why we should burn 80 women and children?
Apparently so. It was justification enough. That's why you take little 6-year-olds and rip them out of their relatives' hands and send them back to a dictatorship.
Yeah, I mean, after all, he was violating the Mann Act. Isn't that under the jurisdiction of the BATF? Oh, excuse me, BATFE?
See, that's Janet Reno, and that's the kind of administration you get, and that's what John Kerry would do.
And back to the phones, and we have Nick. Nick, you're weapons free on America Armed and Free with Colonel Oliver North.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Charles, and semper fi to you, Colonel North.
Semper fi, Nick.
Nick served in Vietnam also in the Marines.
I wanted to ask you about the Iraqi people when you were there. Did you see how they're accepting what the Americans and the coalition forces want to offer them? And what do they think about the continued terrorist attacks?
Well, first of all, you got three different groups that are shooting at Americans. You got the former regime loyalists, the FRLs as they call them, which probably number around 2,500 to 3,000. They have managed to hire, because of the unemployment, soldiers who are out of work, who have nothing else to do and no other way to feed their family except to build IEDs, the improvised explosive devices, that do kill Americans, but increasingly are now killing Iraqis. That's one group. Number two, just before the war, starting in February and again on March 6th, just before the Operation Enduring Freedom began, Saddam opened the jails and let loose every hardened criminal, real criminals. I mean, these are people who don't just panhandle on the streets. These are people who knock over banks and kill people for their possessions. Third group are these foreign fedayeen who've come into the country by the thousands. The Iraqis don't want us to stay there. They love us. I mean, the numbers done by the British when they were polling in Basra and Baghdad showed that 85% of the Iraqi people are glad we're there and we're glad we got rid of Saddam. They don't want us to stay there forever, but they understand they need enough security in order to bring about a democratic transition. So most of the Iraqi people love us. That 15% that said, no, we want to get them out of here right away, are either naive in hoping that somehow they can do this themselves, or they are, if you will, radical clerics, or led by radical clerics, who want a theocracy there.
Yeah, they want to take advantage of a weak time in the country.
If you look at the last draft of their constitution, put together not by Americans but by them, it has a provision for it called freedom of religion, in which you can practice your religion. The Sharia law will govern only issues of culture, not of crime. In other words, it will govern things like divorce and the care of children that are left as orphans and things like that. Now, they may end up calling it the Islamic Republic of Iraq, just like they call it the Islamic Republic of Turkey. But you're not going to end up with a government there that's a theocracy like it is next door in Iran. And quite frankly, I think that what we've got to be about is ensuring that that democratic transition happens sooner rather than later. In the long term, we're going to end up with, and people need to suck up and take a deep breath, we're going to end up with 25 or 30,000 Americans in that country for a protracted period of time. It's probably the best place you can train an armor unit, and we ought to be doing it there instead of Germany. And quite honestly, I can't figure out why we still got 25,000 Americans in Germany.
How many in Japan?
Probably, if you count Okinawa, you get 30,000 out there.
Is that important?
Well, it's important only in regards to what happens in Korea, because you've still got a North Korean military that is obviously very intent on unifying the country their way.
Mm-hmm. Via rattling of sabers.
And keeping U.S. military forces in Japan helps us be able to respond to that and deter it.
Mm-hmm. Nick, to answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to a couple of things. Number one is, I promised I'd come back to it earlier. And, folks, we're talking, if you just tuned in, this is America Armed and Free on AM 1330 KJLL. We're talking to Colonel Oliver North, who's got a brand new book out, War Stories. Also, just in the last few months, you released a sequel to Mission Compromised, right?
The Jericho Sanction.
Yeah, the Jericho Sanction, which I have not had a chance to get my hands on. But I did read Mission Compromise, and that book is largely, although it's fiction, that book is largely true, isn't it?
Well, I've got to make sure that everybody understands it's fiction, because I signed those non-disclosure agreements that will follow me all the way to the grave, so I don't want to violate any of them. But I changed enough the names, times, dates, and places that it's a fictional accounting of a lot of things that happened very much that way. Those three guys at the front end of the book were indeed killed that way, though not exactly at that time. They were people who were involved in stealing a trainload of Soviet arms and turning them over to the Nicaraguan resistance, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, and that passport in the back, Charles,
yes, is you.
Is indeed really my passport.
Right, yes. William
Good. It took me 18
years
to get them to publish that.
That's an inside joke. Go read the book, folks. You'll see what he means. There's a passport with someone else's name on it and Colonel North's picture, and the guy was a real guy who consented to it. There's many people in this country who don't trust the covert acts of government, be it this government or any other. They look at plans like Rex 84 Bravo, which I believe you had a hand in writing, and they see conspiracy. They can see a conspiracy to damage freedom in it. Most people who think that way, I believe, are decent Americans, not collectivists. What do you say to people who mistrust those acts of government?
Well, Charles, I mean, Rex 84 Alpha and Bravo both were exercises designed to make sure you could never decapitate the government of the United States and leave the government of the United States in the hands of guys wearing a blue suit with stripes on the sleeves or a green suit with stars on the collar. I mean, the whole thing was designed to ensure constitutional government in this country, a civilian in charge of the military. And it all came about because under Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski had found out that instead of a 30-minute warning for a Soviet nuclear attack coming over the pole with ICBMs, it was an 11-minute attack coming from a backfire bomber flying down the Virginia Capes launching a cruise missile against Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole purpose of that program. Unfortunately, some of the really hard left in America who didn't want that to be an effective program divulged that program in a way that made it appear that it was an extreme right-wing seizure of control. It was anything but. It was designed to ensure that there would always be civilian control over the government of the United States.
Well, there are enough executive orders in place, and I don't have time to recount them, and not just with the former occupant of the White House, but many before him, that would, in essence, guarantee, if the president signed certain orders, martial law, an extra-constitutional martial law. That scares a lot of people, Colonel North.
Well, martial law doesn't scare anybody. But we also know that, for example, after 9-1-1, you had martial law in New York City. I mean, that's effectively what you had. They didn't call it that.
Right, but that's...
At 9-1-1, in order to make sure that you could even move casualties, you had martial law in New York City.
Yeah, you had...
Was interned, nobody was locked up in the Yankee Stadium or anything like that. It was all done to make sure that you simply had somebody on the streets that just happened to be wearing flak jackets and helmets to make sure that looting didn't take place, to make sure that the people who could be dug out, and thank God hundreds of people were. But it was the U.S. Armed Forces, the National Guard in this case from New York, that moved in and imposed martial law on the biggest city in America. Now, that imposition of martial law, regardless of what it's called, doesn't frighten me. What frightens me is the prospect of somebody like Janet Reno doing what she did at Waco,
mm-hmm.
using, quote, civil authority and using U.S. military resources.
By the way, those resources were under the command of one General Wesley Clark at the time. Charity for Fallen Soldiers. You operate a charity for it, and there are several others. You care to mention any of them?
The Marine Corps Scholarship Fund, the Navy and Army Relief Societies all do that. The Salvation Army runs one specifically for the families of military personnel. My charity, which is I started back in 1990, simply does scholarships for youngsters who've lost a parent serving in the line of duty. The only qualifiers for that scholarship, and it's up to $10,000, is to get into college and have a dad or a mom, in most cases obviously it's a dad, who is killed in the line of duty serving our country in the armed forces of the United States. Simply produce the DD-214 and the college admission slip. The check goes straight to the college, so that, you know, there's no worry about the kid using it for something that would be untoward. And it goes to help those youngsters get an education who otherwise might not get one. Every one of my books has supported that. That's why that website is there that Fox helped me set up, OliverNorth.com.
Colonel North, that's all the time we have. Folks, you hear the music coming up in the background, Lee Greenwood. That means we've reached the end of the hour. I want to encourage each and every one of you to be vigorous, not violent. Be vigilant, not vituperative. In liberty, I'm Charles Heller.